Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Marilyn Pittman. When I tell people I host and produce a gay radio show in San Francisco, I can see that look on their faces like, why? Well, for shows like this one, we have films, we have books and TV shows, yes, but we want to capture our oral history. We want to have a record of the stories of our town and our culture and our history. And this show is that. My guest was a fixture on the gay scene of the 70s and 80s here. He produced many shows and events. He lived through the AIDS crisis, losing many friends and lovers. And he lived to tell the stories in his new memoir, For My Brothers. Mark Abramson, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thank you.
Would you start and just read the first paragraph from your book, Mark?
Okay, chapter one. When a young man believes that he has only a short time left to live, his most logical response might be to spend his remaining days living as hard and as fast as he can. At least that was my gut reaction to the AIDS pandemic. It was also my excuse for every excess during those years.
And every excess is, in part, what your voluminous book is about, is this amazing amount of stories of one day after another, one week after another, before AIDS, during AIDS, but especially before AIDS. That's where I wanted to start, is just to talk about what it was like for you to come from Minneapolis to this city as many gay people were migrating here in the 70s. As it was a gay mecca. It was the place to be freed. It was okay to be gay, unlike every place else. And I want to know, what was your impression? What was it like for you when you first got here that young gay guy?
It was insane. I had just turned 23 about a week before I arrived here, and I'd never been to San Francisco. I didn't know anybody. I didn't think I knew anybody. But there were just so many wonderful people. And the guys all had long hair then. I thought they were beautiful.
It was the 70s, right?
Yeah.
Still had the hippie thing going on.
Yeah. And I read somewhere that there were like something like 1,000 gay men arriving here every week.
Wow. A migration, really.
Yeah. And there was one point I wrote in my journal that I had heard that fact. And I wrote after that, my God, I can never get through them all. I'll never catch up. But that's how it felt back then.
As I put on the Out in the Bay website, sex and drugs and drag shows.
Yeah.
Because it was about sex and drugs but it was almost like the way you write about it. It made me think, you know, was it like a handshake back then? In other words, sex was sort of a way to make friends with people, to build a community. It's sort of the 70s that was true for lesbians, that was true probably for straight people as well, and gay people.
There was just such a sense of freedom. And I think we were rebelling against wherever we'd come from, not having had that freedom.
Uh-huh.
And it was cool to be gay, you know, in San Francisco, whereas it wasn't anywhere else.
Right.
In the country, really. Maybe some parts of the biggest cities each had their own little area.
And the Castro wasn't really the Castro then. It was really on Polk Street, the gay
Street
scene.
And Folsom Street.
Folsom Street down south of Market.
And Haight Street had its bars. But in those days, every neighborhood had a gay bar. I mean, there was a bar out at the ocean called Dick's at the Beach.
Dick's at the Beach. And, you know, I remember there was one in Pacific Heights that was kind of a fern bar, if you will. What was that called? Lion's Den?
There were three.
There were three.
There was Lion's Pub.
Lion's
and
Pub.
There was Numbers. And there was...
So that was for, like, the business guys?
Yeah.
The professional class, et cetera.
Yeah. And downtown, there were...
On Kearney.
There was Sutter's Mill and Trinity Place. Sutter's Mill had several locations. But I used to work in the Transamerica Pyramid. I was a waiter at lunchtime. And my friend Bill and I would get off work, ride Muni back to the Castro, put on suits and ties, and go back downtown to Sutter's Mill. Because we pretend that we work downtown. I mean, we did work downtown, but we weren't suit and tie guys, you know.
But we wanted to
meet those guys, yeah. And then we'd go home and take off our suits and ties and put on our other clothes and go south the market, you know.
Jeans and leather.
Yeah. But the Castro was just barely starting out.
Well, it was a Swedish, Italian, or...
I think it was Italian mostly, yeah.
But you had the Swedish-American Hall as well, and you had that Swedish restaurant there on Market.
Wasn't that great?
Remember that Swedish restaurant? Where you could go in for like $5 and eat like a huge plate of food at lunch?
Massive.
It was just amazing.
And I'm Swedish. I loved that place.
There you go.
Yeah.
But the gays kind of took over that neighborhood ultimately. That happened really with the migration.
Yeah.
Of the late 70s.
Well, there were a lot of gay bars in the Haight, too, and I felt like the Haight was kind of spilling over after the Summer of Love. The Haight was spilling over the hill into the Castro.
Uh-huh.
There were about 8 or 10 gay bars in the Haight-Ashbury at one point.
Wow.
Yeah. And now there's only Tracks.
There is even a gay bar over there? I don't even know
Tracks
that anymore.
Tracks is the only one.
Mark Abramson is my guest here on Out in the Bay. He's the author of For My Brothers. It's a new memoir that captures the time of wildness and joy in community here in San Francisco in the 70s and 80s, including into the AIDS crisis. Let's go there for a second. You survived. You're a survivor.
I'm doing well.
You're HIV positive since 1988.
88, yeah.
And you didn't die when everyone else seemed to.
Undetectable viral load for the last 10 years, 20 years almost.
What do you attribute that to, Mark?
Well, the new protease inhibitors, they're not new anymore.
So was it like you made it to 96 and then you were okay?
Yeah. My partner died in 95, and about 6 months later, the new drugs came out, and my doctor said, "You're a perfect candidate for this study." They weren't approved yet. But he said, "I can get you on a study, and let's go for it." And I said, "Sure, what have I got to lose?"
And that was really the difference between many people living and many people dying, was that 6 months.
Yeah. Oh. And people are still, we're still dying
we're
a
still
lot
dying
after that.
Yes.
Because they didn't get on the drugs in time, or they didn't know. People still die from AIDS now, but thank God, not nearly...
Not
as
like
often.
They did.
No,
and it was a death sentence at that point.
I think I wrote in the book at one point in 1987, someone died of AIDS in San Francisco every 7 hours.
At the end of your book, For My Brothers, you have, at the end of the book, you put a chronology of the deaths of the people that you knew in this community. And there are hundreds of names, and they go on for pages and pages and pages.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering why you did that. What was the significance of putting that in your book?
I felt like those people deserved to be listed.
So sort of like the Names Project, naming them.
Yeah.
Remember our names.
And also because so much of the book, looking back at those times, so much of it seemed kind of surreal to me. I mean, yeah, we did a lot of drugs, but still it seemed surreal to me, even remembering the stories. And at the end, I wanted to ground the book in the reality of those people's names.
Most of whom died from AIDS, but some who were murdered?
What I did was I sat down with the BAR's online directory of obituaries. The obituaries in the BAR have run for years and years and years. And I read every single obituary.
The Bay Area Reporter he's talking about, ebar.com, if you want to find that.
Yeah, I read every single obituary from 1984 to 96.
Wow.
Just because I felt like I had to,
To revisit it.
To revisit it. And as I was writing this book, it took me about 6 months to read them all. And each time I recognized anybody, I made a note of it and put them list in order.
Well, it's quite powerful. It's quite intense. You finish the book and you get to the end of it, and then there's that. And it just goes page after page after page after page. 84, 85, 86, 87. And it just goes on, and names you recognize, and I recognize, and names I don't, obviously.
Sure.
But it was like that back then, where every week in the BAR, the main gay paper at the time, you would look to see the obituaries. Who died this week?
And sometimes there were a couple of pages of them with their photographs, and sometimes I knew everyone.
At 25, at 32?
Oh, yeah.
And that was kind of the age of the men who were dying at that time. They were young.
Very.
And including your lover, you ended up falling in love.
Yeah.
With this amazing man named Kelly during the AIDS crisis, those AIDS years, in the 80s, right?
We met in 91.
Oh, 91,
mm-hmm.
Which was also sort of the peak of it in some sense also.
Yeah. Yeah, it was before any of the drugs came out. We both, when we met, we figured out, we immediately discussed, as we did in those days.
Are you positive? Are
you positive?
Negative?
Yeah, and I assumed everyone was. Everyone I knew was.
Well, and by 91, we knew how it was transmitted, and we knew that condoms helped prevent it.
Yeah. But it was too late for Kelly and me, and we both knew we were positive. Right. So we thought, why not spend the rest of our lives together, what little there will be of that? And he, you know, he really wanted us to move in together right away, and I had my 1 year rule.
Yeah, he had that lesbian tendency.
Yeah. Oh yeah, U-Haul. No. But we just lived.
But you
around,
had your 1 year rule.
Yeah, we just lived around the corner from each other. So I thought, well, this will work out. We can just keep, you know, because I had given up a fabulous apartment back in the 70s that was in the Castro.
A two bedroom, yeah.
$165 a month.
Don't tell people that now.
I'm sure it's worth it.
There's too much going on in the city these days.
Yes. But I had given that up to move in with somebody that I thought I was in love with, and I never.
Again. You weren't going to do that again.
I'm not going to do that again.
Yeah, I think we all only do that one once.
Yeah. So then my apartment burned down, so I had no choice. And Kelly and I found a great place on Castro Street, which is under rent control, and I'm still there.
Are you really?
Yeah. I'm still there. And
is it a big building? Is that why it's still...
It's a six-unit Victorian.
Six. Yeah. Well, it could be sold. You know how it is right now.
Yeah. Well, knock on wood.
Let's not go there.
Yeah, let's not go there.
Well, back to the book. You're listening to Out of the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. My guest is Mark Abramson. He has written this brilliant, amazing book, an oral history for our gay culture in the city here, called For My Brothers. You can find it at Amazon, Books, Inc., WildCity.com. That's the publisher, Wild with an E, WildCity.com. You can also find his fiction work at BeachReading.net. It's such a pleasure to have you here. You were such an amazing event producer all those years, before AIDS and then during AIDS, to raise money. You produced this thing called Men Behind Bars. Tell us what that is.
Well, it started out being bartenders. My friend Jim was a bartender, Jim Svetanich, and the year that he was Mr. San Francisco Leather, he thought he should do something with his title, and he wanted to do a variety show. So he asked me to help him put it together, and it was a one-night deal, one night in January of 1984, and I got us Val Diamond to be the guest star.
Val Diamond, who was the star at that time, and for many years of Beach Blanket Babylon,
yeah,
in North Beach.
Yeah, and we just got together all our bartender friends and said, who can do what? And put together this silly little show with song and dance and some drag queens lip syncing and some a little of this, a little of that. We got the Tap Troupe, the San Francisco Tap Troupe, to perform. I think they opened each act. Mm-hmm. And we got Mr. Marcus to MC, who was the leather columnist in the BAR.
Yes, he was the...
And so he plugged
quite
the heck,
a man about town.
Plugged the heck out of it in his column, which got a lot of people to buy tickets. And then all the bartenders who were going to make fools of themselves on stage made sure all their friends came. So we sold out the Victoria Theater. I mean, it's 500 seats. But
that's in the Mission, for the that don't know the Victoria.
Each year we got bigger and bigger and bigger.
And then as AIDS took over our consciousness and our lives, you just kept producing and kept doing more and more things. And then it became fundraisers. And then you started hiring out gay comics like Tom Amiano and Marga Gomez and Danny Williams. You started working with Sylvester and the Weather Girls. And you started, you know, you knew Donald Montwell, who used to run Josie's, the gay cabaret in the Castro.
Donald was a dear friend because he was a customer. When I worked as a bartender on Castro Street, I got to know him across the bar. I got to know so many people as a bartender. And Donald was one who would come in when it was slow, and he was always somebody just great to visit with. And it turned out we had so many friends in common.
Including Jane Dornacker,
yeah.
So let's talk about Jane. You want to read a little bit more from your book, For My Brothers? This is about Jane Dornacker. Mark Abramson here on Out in the Bay.
I have always had women friends. I am able to spend long periods of time in strictly male environments, but growing up with so much female energy in my family, I eventually began to miss women. Jane Dornacker was becoming one of my closest women friends. I'd gotten to know her when she performed at the Woods at the Russian River. When I moved back to San Francisco, I booked a few paying gigs for her and asked her to do some benefits, too. Part of my reason for wanting women in my life might also have been because they weren't dying of AIDS like so many of the men around me were. When I made friends with a woman, I assumed, no, I expected our friendship would last forever. My first day on my new apartment on McCoppin Street, I moved a few boxes and small pieces of furniture out of Roger's garage on Seward. Jane came by that night with champagne and sushi from our favorite Japanese restaurant near Union Square, just south of the Stockton Tunnel. We sat cross-legged on the floor, eating and laughing, drinking and smoking pot and cigarettes. Jane smoked unfiltered Camels, the smoke wafting up through her huge mane of burgundy hair. I'm sure we did a few lines of coke and laughed some more, listening to an old transistor radio for music. Jane was a local radio star in those days. She was a stand-up comedian by night, but in the daytime she was the trafficologist on KFRC. She made traffic reporting funny. We have a vicular flambé in the northbound lanes of the Golden Gate Bridge, so there'll be some delays if you're headed out of town that way. It looks like yet another driver has failed to maintain the master-subordinate relationship with his automobile.
There will never be another Jane Dornocker because of the, I mean, there's funny people doing the weather and doing the traffic, but really, I mean, that's a stand-up comic inventing language, describing things in this really almost erudite, witty, snarky, funny, just brilliant, brilliant woman who unfortunately isn't with us anymore. So tell us about that. Those of you who don't know about Jane Dornocker, you should.
Well, there's a lot in the book. Jane moved to New York. She told me one day that she was really good friends with Whoopi Goldberg, and she and Whoopi had done a show together at the Victoria.
Whoopi lived in Berkeley.
Yeah. And Whoopi was just starting out back in those days, and she and Jane did a show together, a two-woman show together at the Victoria Theater. And she told me one day that Whoopi and Robin Williams had convinced her, talked her into moving to New York because they thought her career would really take off there. And I I had to, you know, say, well, go for it. But I really didn't want her to leave. And she went to New York and got a job doing traffic again, but on the radio. But this time she did it from the helicopter. And a few months later, the helicopter crashed in the Hackensack River. And Jane swam to shore. And I read about it in Herb Cain, and then we talked on the phone the next night, and I was kind of shaken up about it, but I told her, well, Jane, you know, you've got to just get back there. You can't be afraid of this. You're the
lightning
strongest person.
Lightning never strikes
person.
Twice at the same
it's like falling off a horse. You got to get right back on it. And about 6 months later, the helicopter went down again, and this time in the Hudson River, and Jane died. And
she died from the second one.
The second one, yeah.
Which I'm sure made you feel many different things, including, I can't believe I said that, but it's not your fault. It's everybody would have said that, you know? You want to encourage people. You live through it. Oh, that can't happen. We all believe that. That can't happen twice.
Yeah. And men were supposed to die, not women. You know, men were dying. All my friends were dying, but women were not supposed to die because women didn't get AIDS. And
so they were going to live beyond us and be there for us.
They were going to take care of us.
Well, they did.
And, well, yeah, a lot of them did.
Well, but lesbians, but...
Yeah.
So that was devastating to all of those who love Jane Dornocker, but to you especially, being such good friends and having really been almost her manager here, producing her and working with her and... Getting high with her.
I told Herb Cain one time at a party right after Jane died. I said, you know, she always called me her manager, but as if anyone could manage her. There was no way. I got her a lot of bookings, though, and we always had fun going to them and afterward hanging out.
You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. My guest is Mark Abramson, the author of the memoir For My Brothers. You can find it online, wildcity.com, Amazon Books, Inc. It's a story, it's a memoir, and it's an oral history about growing up, not growing up, I guess growing up, you're in the early 20s, in San Francisco, coming of age in San Francisco in the 70s and into the 80s. And you have lived. You have HIV now. You're in your 60s. And you're sorry. Did I not say that?
It's so true.
You just cracked 60. Okay, is that
anybody better? Anybody can look up my real date of birth in the
Wikipedia
or card catalog or something.
But and you look vibrant, and you know. So I'm just wondering if you went through that whole survivor guilt that people did during AIDS, where they didn't die and they wondered why they didn't when everyone else seemed to die.
Well, writing this book helped a lot. I mean,
your art will heal you.
I felt like it was very gratifying to get all this. And I couldn't have written this 20 years ago or even 10 years ago. I needed this much time to pass for me to be able to go back and think and remember all these people without just being sad about it, because I didn't want to make the book a big downer.
No, the book is not a downer.
Funny stories.
It's sad. It's poignant. It's deep. But it's also entertaining reading. I mean, it's one story after another of some drug escapade, sex. I mean, the Russian River stories themselves, because the Russian River was the gay, you know, vacation spot and still is to some extent, I suppose. But those were the days up there of just complete, like, wild naked men in the bushes, kind of, you know, nature and men and...
Yeah, and I was there while AIDS was just coming into the city, and people were aware of it more in San Francisco. So when I moved back, it was kind of a shock to me.
You had been living in Russian River in the early 80s, and then you moved to the city. And
I moved back to the city.
It was the thing.
Yeah, boy, because earlier I'd been in the city, I was in my 20s, and it was just wild and crazy. When I moved back from three years at the Russian River, the city had changed so much.
What's your take, Mark Abramson, on how younger generations of gay men deal with HIV status, behavior, et cetera? You contracted the virus at a time when we didn't know how we got it, and now we know for many 30 years. And so I'm just wondering what your take is on new rates of transmission and...
Well, you know, there's a whole topic
that
you probably don't have time for about the Truvada, people taking Truvada as a preventative. And there's a lot of shaming going on. People are calling people Truvada whores because they're taking Truvada so that they could have unsafe sex.
What is Truvada, like a morning after pill or something?
No, it's one of the HIV drugs.
Oh, I see.
I mean, I've been taking it for years as a protease inhibitor, mm-hmm. but people are taking it who are healthy in order to prevent getting AIDS. And I think, why not? I mean, if there was something like that around when I was, before I was mm-hmm. diagnosed, I certainly would have taken it.
Well, do you think we're doing enough to educate young men about safe sex? Because for the years after we learned what caused AIDS, there was safe sex, and condoms everywhere. And there still are condoms everywhere. And there was a real education effort at prevention, and rates went down, and then there were spikes in that in the younger generations.
You know,
it's been a struggle.
The seventh book in my beach reading series called, what's it called? Seven books I've forgotten.
Anyway, senior year.
Yes. The last book is called Love Rules. And in it, there's a subplot about a kid who is a bug chaser. And that used to be a thing back in the day when young people who were negative wanted to be positive because they didn't want to have to deal with condoms. They figured, oh, well, once I get it, then I can just go on these new drugs.
Right.
And be fine. And so I put this character in, and it was kind of based on someone that I actually contacted me, and I just freaked out. I couldn't do it. But then later on, I thought, boy, this is a pretty good plot line, somebody wanting to do this. And he says, well, my mother takes a pill so that she doesn't get pregnant. What's the difference?
So it doesn't sound like you have a lot of judgment on what's going on.
Well, no, I can't.
But it's hard to watch.
I can't judge anybody. I mean, the only thing I'm judgmental about is meth. And I think that's doing more damage to the gay community.
Well, at least unsafe sex, unprotected sex and barebacking. So there's that. Let's talk a little bit about what was really the story that you tell about AZT. AZT was the first sort of AIDS drug, and it if you've seen Dallas Buyers Club, you'll learn about that there if you don't know anything about it. But it really was something that everyone took for a while. And would you read that bit in the book? This is Mark Abramson, his memoir, For My Brothers. This is out in the Bay.
In 1988, I had HMO coverage with Kaiser from my bartending job on Castro Street. I was seeing my doctor there for something else entirely when he ordered a bunch of blood work, which, unbeknownst to me, included an HIV test. When I came back for the follow-up visit, he opened the door and closed it behind him, but he didn't sit down or come any closer. He said, "You tested positive for HIV. Here's a prescription for AZT." That was it. He left it on the desk and walked out. I can't say that I was surprised about the diagnosis, but still I was stunned at his attitude. I had expected I was positive all along, but for a doctor, especially in San Francisco, to be too frightened to come near me and so unenlightened about the means of transmission of the virus was shocking. Nearly everyone I knew carried an off-white plastic pill box with a built-in timer and a sliding lid that concealed the little blue and white AZT capsules. If I was in the Castro Theater for a matinee movie at 4 o'clock, I would hear them beeping all around me in the dark. In gay restaurants at 8 p.m., the waiters walked through the dining room with a tray of glasses of water so that everybody could take their AZT pills. Every 4 hours around the clock, no matter where I was, the timer went off to remind me that I was dying. With my diagnosis, I had finally, officially joined the ranks of my friends. And here I am, more than two decades later, alive and kicking. The time has come to tell some of the stories of those days for the sake of all my friends who are lost and only remain here in spirit.
And that's why you wrote this book.
Yeah, yeah.
To honor them.
Exactly.
And to keep them alive with us. To let us know who they were, how they were, what they did, what it was like.
Yeah.
Since they didn't get to live much past 30, 35.
Boy, and I feel like I have to take advantage of every day for all of them because they're not here to enjoy what
this life is.
Yeah, what it is. I mean, they died young and pretty. I can always envy them that. Not so pretty, though. Not a good way to go.
No, it wasn't pretty at all.
No,
actually, it was a hideous disease.
Yeah.
It still is, but it was certainly devastating to all of us, as well as them, the people who lost their lives from it. So it's amazing that you've given us this book. It's entertaining because it's just naughty and wrong and fun and sexy and stoned a lot. And you're talking about being stoned and not remembering. I mean, I can't believe you wrote this book. You were so stoned. How did you remember all of this stuff?
I know somebody wrote that in a review that he wasn't sure whether it was more amazing that I was still here or that I could remember anything. Because I was,
But you took notes. You kept a journal. You've always been a writer.
I've always kept a journal. Mm-hmm. Although there were some gaps in the journal keeping during those years. And I was, fortunately, I could remember or remember enough to fill in the gaps.
Well, it's really wonderful to have you here and to share the book with us tonight.
I'm so glad that people are enjoying it. It's great to hear from people. Even you were talking about the list of the dead at the end.
Yes.
I got an email the other day from someone on the East Coast who'd never been to San Francisco, and he said that he and his partner had read my book on vacation, and they were both reading it a second time, and they knew some of the people that were listed at the end, never having been to San Francisco, and they could relate to it anyway. So I'm really glad. I'd kind of written it for the people that are in it. You know, even though they're not here to read it, I'd written it for my brothers.
Amazing.
So,
well, it's a gift. So thank you very much for being here and for writing it.
Thank you for having me.
Mark Abramson, the author of For My Brothers. It's a new memoir. Check it out on Amazon or at Books Inc. or wildcity.com. Thanks again, Mark.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. We turned 10 years old this year, but it can sometimes feel like 50 when we don't hear from you. But hey, it's May, which means the second annual Give Out Day is almost here. It's a national day of online giving for LGBT nonprofits, which we are. Last year, a $10 donation helped us win $3,000, so that was huge. We're a lean operation. This year, $5,000 is on the line, so the Give Out Day challenge grants are based on the number of donors, not how much. So even a small donation, $10, makes a huge difference. So go to outinthebay.org, outinthebay.org, and hit the donate now button. Go ahead, I'll wait. Just one donation. Please, Out in the Bay had the second highest number of donors among Bay Area LGBT nonprofits with small budgets, and it really showed us how much what we give you is important to you. It inspires Eric Jansen and I to keep this show going. Believe me, we really do it mostly out of love. Your contribution really could be the one to get us a much-needed extra grant this year. Thanks to the staff and management of KALW, Joanne Marr is our engineer. Out in the Bay is produced by Eric Jansen and me. I'm Marilyn Pittman. Thanks for joining me.